Welcome to the Lifetime Body Podcast, where we discuss how to kick ass for life through the pursuit of ultimate wellness, peak performance, and maximum longevity. Kicking ass for life is not just about achieving health or fitness or long lifespans alone. It's about totally kicking ass at everything you do in life. In every episode, join me, author and human performance expert John Zombro, and my amazing co-hosts and guests. We'll dive into the science of exercise physiology, biomechanics, nutrition, physical therapy, lifestyle, and more to meld the concepts of optimal living and advanced training. You'll explore how to look, feel, and perform your best as you live your healthiest, happiest, most successful, and longest life. Let's kick ass for life. Hi, guys, and welcome to the Lifetime Body Podcast. I'm your host, John Zombro, and this is episode number 44. So for those of you in the know, number 44, that makes me Dirty Harry, episode 44, Magnum. And if you're a millennial and you don't know that, please look it up because you need to. So this episode is entitled, Is Your Diet Working for You? Part one, and it's going to be an interesting one. But before I get started, I want to give a shout out. Last week was the shout out show, the first of many, and I showed my appreciation for some of the wonderful people who support the things that go on here at the Lifetime Body. And I got a message from Ruthie K. Shout out to Ruthie K. Thank you. And she said, "Hey, I noticed that you didn't sing in the last episode, and so." This one's for Ruthie. Shout it, shout it, shout it out loud. And of course, as you know, that was Kiss. That was Gene, Ace, Paul, and Peter doing Shout It Out Loud. And so shout out to you, Ruthie, and thank you so, so much. So here we go. Is your diet working for you? Well, first of all, it's fun to experiment. And it can be very interesting and informative when you experiment on yourself. One of the easiest and perhaps most productive areas in which to conduct personal investigations is in the realm of dietary intake. Through trial and error and a little good science, you can learn what foods really work or don't for you. Done strategically, you can even improve your health and performance quite effectively. This is an update on some dietary experiments that I have recently undertaken or that have been ongoing for a number of years. It seems like I've always got some kind of experiment going on at any given time. With my Science Project series books, I've applied and tested a number of conventional and non-traditional health and performance practices. In Project Full Circle Squared, I manipulated training and recovery methods to break 60 seconds in the 400 meter run as a 52-year-old. In Project 9-10-17, I messed around with ketogenic diets, macronutrient ratios, body composition, and metabolic states. And with Project Jacked, I had the great opportunity to work with 30 plus willing subjects to collaborate in designing and testing a comprehensive weight loss, fitness, health enhancement, and metabolic reset program. Last summer, I had a goal of training to race a fast, for me, a mile, laugh if you want, but injury forced me to turn that into an investigation of how fast I could go without actually training very much at all. I took my less is more philosophy into almost nothing is nothing, and training became naming, but you can read about it if you'd like to look that up on the blog. But perhaps what intrigues me most is how diet can impact health and performance. In this missive, I'm going to attempt to describe some of the dietary experiments that I've conducted and share my personal results. I don't have all the answers about a perfect diet, never will. But I've learned some things about how certain foods affect my own physiology, and I'm hoping you'll get something from that as well. I've come up with a lot of questions as I've gone along. And my goal here today is to offer you an opportunity to reflect on my findings and possibly test out some questions of your own. Indeed, we should all be our own guinea pigs or lab rats in the N equals one experiment known as life. Before we can look at specific food folly, let's acknowledge some of the challenges of the personal dietary experiment. Whether you are testing something, whenever you're testing something, you have to try your best to keep all other factors relatively constant, so as to be able to try to attribute any outcome to the one variable, which in this case would be diet, that you are attempting to isolate. This means that dietary experiments work best in the context of consistency. That's consistency with sleep, stress, training, relationships, etc. Anytime lots of things are changing concurrently, it gets very difficult to identify the degree to which any specific factor is affecting an outcome. And we have to find some measures that are reliable. A mix of objective markers, such as blood tests, body composition, performance output, along with subjective indicators like energy, enthusiasm, appetite, attitude, must all be evaluated. And also we need repeatability. Testing a hypothesis multiple times and getting similar results is necessary for any dietary application to hold merit. So let's get into food. Food is many things, and it can be both poison and powerful medicine. This is perhaps the reason each of us should consider which foods support our best health, performance, and longevity. Every condition is multifactorial, but in most cases, if you don't look, feel, and perform at your best or close to it, there's a high probability that your diet just isn't optimal. If you have some acne, skin rashes, gut disturbances, low energy, muscle stiffness, joint aches, excess body fat, poor moods, depression, disease, and that's a long list, something's not right. And this absolutely involves all of the things in life, our movement, our stress, our light management, relationships, environmental toxins, sleep, many other things. But it would be fair to state that your diet is probably not working optimally for you if those things, again, aren't ideal. An experiment may be in order with the power lever of life known as food. We all have the potential to be healthier and higher performing when we accept this fact. Maybe stop denying it and embrace the mix of science and wisdom. So if you're not at your best, your diet's probably not ideal, and you just might want to make yourself a lab rat in the name of health. One of the more peculiar factors about diets is their tendency to morph into cult-like entities. In this case, a particular style of food consumption ends up being named after a person such as Dr. Robert Atkins, or a time in history like the Paleolithic era, a specific metabolic effect as in ketogenic, or a class of food with examples being carnivorous or raw food vegan. These terms are often useful and descriptive, but the tendency is for the dietary approach to evolve into a lifestyle and in some cases, dare I say, a religion. This isn't always positive, and I'm not sure it's generally necessary. As many readers will recognize, I call my approach to eating the planet-based diet, or PBD. That's planet, P-L-A-N-E-T. While the name sounds like a sarcastic play on the term plant-based, and it is, in all seriousness, it's my descriptor for a natural, healthy, whole foods diet that includes both animal and plant products. The PBD food resembles its earthly origins and does not look like processed food-like substances from a space mission. It shows concern for the environment, respect for people, plants, and animals, and is ultimately deeply nourishing. Deeply nourishing, that's what I tried to get out there. The PBD is consistent with our genes, and it's what the human or lifetime body machine runs on best. The PBD is based on the Just Eat Real Food, or J-E-R-F, JERF, principle. The PBD is the nutritional anchor of my work and my writing, and it's easy to understand, and it's a simple to use concept. That, in a nutshell, depending on how you feel about consuming nuts, is the PBD. So one of my earliest experiments, getting right into this, was more of an intervention, and it happened almost a decade ago. I'm thinking you might laugh along with me, hopefully not at me too much. I've always been fit and athletic, but in my late 40s, I found myself not as healthy as I knew I should be and as I wanted to be. I had become insulin resistant. I'd gained a few pounds, and I was borderline hypertensive and pre-diabetic. That's type 2 diabetes. This was a wake-up call, and it led me to clean up my diet and essentially get rid of the dessert foods to which I had been addicted all my life. I always ate a fairly healthy diet, but I had a real sweet tooth. Every meal usually had a treat, such as a sticky bun following my omelet at breakfast, a few cookies after lunch, and maybe some cake pie or ice cream at the end of an otherwise nutritious dinner. Pretty much every day for 40 years. Because I'd always been athletic, I'd been led to believe you could just burn anything you consumed without consequence. The sports nutrition industry supported this position and marketed all sorts of junk food products with athletic nutrition in quotations labels. I pounded all of them. And much to my dismay, my health began to deteriorate. My clinical experience in working with literally thousands of folks is that you can get away with throwing garbage at your metabolism for about 30 years. Sometimes I call that the 30-year rule before starts to break down. I got an extra decade out of that situation, probably partially due to my genetics and also the benefits of regular training, which can temporarily offset metabolic dysregulation in many of us. It actually, exercise can make us more insulin sensitive and thus sort of counteract the insulin resistance that may be building due to poor diet, among other things. Alas, the innocence and decadence of CAKE, and that's C-A-K-E, possibly an acronym for can actually kill everyone, occurred to me. Despite their delicious nature, all those delightful dessert goodies contain almost entirely the evil triad, that thing we've talked about here a lot on the show. Those are the refined sugars, the processed grains, and the seed oils, which are bad enough alone, but in cakes, cookies, pies, they're usually the hydrogenated variety, which is worse. So I pretty much kicked that habit cold turkey. And in just a few months, it's amazing, my health was restored and my weight normalized without really doing anything else, except one thing. I know we're talking about food, but I want to share this. I cut my training in half, times three. And what I mean is I did about half as much training at half the intensity, about half as often. Over several months. And I realized that my motivation was exceeding my recovery abilities. And that's also related to the junk food consumption. And I was doing less training, which I found to be very effective in reducing the chronic inflammatory states, which were produced both by my overzealous exercise habits as well as my my garbage consumption. Both proven to do that. So this was also when I started really seeing phenomenal improvements or phenomenal results with a lot of clients that I was working with, and not just in weight loss, but in performance enhancement. And that's due to the realization that the fork is mightier than the running shoe or the dumbbell, although these things have value. But in the pursuit of body composition, ideal body composition, that fork was very powerful. So with garbage food, and it's interesting, I don't even know why these two words really are put together, garbage food, junk food, they don't belong together. And with that stuff out of my diet, my macronutrient ratios naturally took a shift. Carbohydrates were mainly coming from plant sources. So total or net carbohydrates went down as healthy dietary fat from nature, not from manufacturing plants, climbed up a bit. Protein stayed about the same, and my default diet became a low-carb, healthy-fat, or LCHF diet, if you like that term. And I began to enjoy the wonder of becoming metabolically fat-adapted. My metabolism switched over from being very carbohydrate-dependent to being able to use and prefer, in most cases, fat for fuel. This could be ingested dietary fat or stored body fat. It was quite liberating to be free of all those cravings and crashes that the carb cycle had me on. So honestly, metabolic fat adaptation really just means having a healthy, naturally functioning metabolism that is consistent with our genetics. When we look at the three major macronutrients of fat, protein, and carbohydrate, each has unique properties. Protein is mainly a building block for various parts of the body, and it's not really a metabolically efficient or desired source of energy. Carbs provide fuel for the red blood cells and parts of the brain, and are also used in high output or high octane circumstances. But keep in mind, we can make our own carbs or make our own glucose, and it's not entirely necessary or essential to ingest them. Perhaps more on that another time. The fat adapted, or maybe we should use what is currently the more popular term, metabolically flexible body, can easily use either carbs, primarily in the form of glucose, or fatty acids from triglycerides for fuel. Let's put it this way. A carb-dependent metabolism can only burn glucose, and it can't utilize fat, can't access it. But a flexible metabolism can burn either. We have this dual fuel system by brilliant evolutionary design. It's just necessary to restrict carbohydrate intake enough to upregulate or turn back on our fat-burning enzymes, hormones, and cellular machinery. For most of us, this process only requires a few weeks to a few months at most. So next, I started experimenting with all the various interpretations of the paleo diet that were becoming popular. I did this for two reasons. One, I had begun to study ancestral biology and medical anthropology a bit, and I liked the premise upon which the paleo diet was based. It made sense to eat in accordance with the genome. Two, I was enamored with the books and websites which were popping up and showing all these colorful, wonderful, delectable platters. I enjoyed exploring different versions of paleo diet. There were several takeaways for me during this phase. I experimented with a variety of nuts, seeds, and fruits, as this was part of most protocols. In the end, I found that I did a bit better when I kept those foods very low to moderate in my consumption. Mainly, it just drove my carb intake a bit higher than my previously wrecked metabolism preferred. Again, you know, your results may vary. I also embraced the abolition of all grains from my diet. I'd had some DNA and gut testing that supported this move, and I'd also used a blood glucose monitor, to test my response to most grains, and they tended to spike my levels to pre-diabetic in most cases, so eliminated those. And lastly, I further embraced nose-to-tail animal consumption for optimal nutrition. This was something I'd always done, but based on my experiments and study of nutritional biochemistry, I now consume liver and bone broth on a more frequent basis. Hey folks, thanks so much for listening today. This show and every episode of the podcast is brought to you by The Lifetime Body. At TLB, we offer a life-changing collection of services that include one-on-one health consultations, performance coaching and training packages, and inspiring workshops revolving around the five life-optimizing components of food, movement, sleep, ergonomics, and awareness. Whether you're looking to tune up your health or body composition, train more effectively and get results in athletics, or bring wellness and productivity-enhancing workshops to your group or business, we've got you covered. Check out thelifetimebody.com, click on the services menu item, and start kicking ass for life today. Now back to the show. Then came the ketogenic experiments, particularly as part of Project 91017. We were all, ancestral humans that is, keto before it was modern and cool to say, I'm keto. While debate and controversy rages on whether primitive man existed on low-carb and high-fat diets, one thing is certain, early man had the occasional famine to go with his feasting. The human can get into a ketogenic state either through prolonged fasting of several days or through very restricted carbohydrate intake. Either way, in relation to fatty acid metabolism, the liver will make ketones, and beta hydroxybutyrate is the one most commonly measured in the blood, which can be used as fuel in much of the body, including a significant portion of the brain. There are numerous health and longevity benefits associated with ketogenic states. It does seem that this may be most natural or beneficial if it's cyclical. In other words, optimal health occurs when our periods of nutritional ketosis are interspersed with intervals of refeeding when our macronutrient considerations are less stringent. Regardless of the evolving science, I noticed that cyclic ketogenic states enhance my mental clarity and overall feelings of well-being. The major lesson for me was that carbs really had to be limited to a few servings of essentially non-starchy vegetables, broccoli, kale, cauliflower, spinach, etc., for example. And to go have that go along with my fish, eggs, meat, olive oil, and the usual things that are in my diet, in order for my blood ketone monitor to register a state of definitive ketosis. Some ketogenic diets advocate quite a strong limit on protein and an extreme emphasis on fat intake. I found that I didn't need to go quite this far to get into ketosis most of the time, as long as I minimized my carb intake. again, everyone's different, but that was my outcome. Fasting, it's an ancient tradition and a centerpiece of most religions and cultures worldwide. As opposed to unplanned famine, fasting is the regular practice of food restriction. It's been shown to enhance immune function and to assist with the cellular cleanup process known as autophagy. These are among the many health and longevity enhancing benefits of fasting. And there are a few methodologies for doing so. I've tried most of them. The most strict, which is the multi-day water-only fast, is perhaps the most extreme. I've been doing one of these fasts each year for several years with a duration of 3 to 5 days. Frankly, the 3-day version is fairly easy, but I found the 5 days to be challenging. You really need to plan your fast for a quiet time in life with lots of rest and little training, travel, or stress. This is probably one reason why many cultures schedule their fasts around meditation retreats. Other forms of fasting include the concept of intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding. This is basically the practice of consuming all of one's food each day during a compressed window of time. These mini fasts are shown to be quite effective at getting most of the benefits of extended water fasts without the potential negatives. Research supports health improvement with a 12-12 or 12-hour feed and 12-hour fast cycle, and results tend to be greater when that eating window is shrunk to 4 to 6 hours per day. I personally use about a 10-hour window for eating on most days, and that would give me 14 hours of fasting. But when I want to shred body fat, I'll reduce that to 6 to 7 hours, still eating about the same amount of food. Some folks use a one meal a day or OMAD approach, and this would be a 1 and 23-hour sequence. There's also a calorie restricted or protein sparing or fasting mimicking dietary approach. Newer research indicates that these approaches can induce many of the same benefits of extended fasts, and they tend to provide some safeguard against the loss of lean body mass, and that would be muscle, bone, and organ tissue. The message with all these fasting interventions is that we are by nature designed to experience periods of not eating, or at least reduced food intake. This is programmed into our genetics and has beneficial effects. The constant feeding pattern of modern life and the standard American diet, SAD, SAD, is antithetical to this genetic wiring. In a sense, all these fasting interventions didn't have cute names. They were just a part of life. They happened automatically. We didn't have to eat clinically because our natural existence provided a mix of feasting and fasting, although probably not always ideal. But the human's a durable beast. I try to find a balance between the fed and fasted state, and I find such a blend gives me my best energy and recovery. Vegetable intake. It's an interesting one. We've always been told to eat our veggies, that they were good for us, and that you probably couldn't eat too many. I did the eat the rainbow kick for a while, in which I really tried to get all the colorful produce I could pack in every day, about 10 cups per day into my system. That never seemed to sit right with my gut, no matter how selective or progressive I made that consumption. Ironically, high veggie intake drove up my inflammation markers, and I tested this multiple times with blood tests, high sensitivity C-reactive protein, homocysteine, erythrocyte sedimentation rate, and a few other markers would elevate when I was eating the 10 cups per day, whereas moderate amounts didn't do that to me. So this could possibly be related to lectin and phytate overload, and those are two known classes of anti-nutrient and autoimmune response provokers in plants. It could be the supplanting of omega-3 fatty acids, which are anti-inflammatory, from the excessive plant intake, thus displacing enough animal products in my diet. It could be any number of things, and I don't know for sure, but what I do know is that eating 10 cups of vegetables per day made me less healthy than eating about 2 or 4 cups, which seems about right for me. I do like the color, the taste, and the texture that these things provide on my plate. So, you know, I don't think I'm going to eliminate them further. But I found my ideal amount, and I think that's really the point I wanted to make there. Fiber. I'm not convinced we need as much of it as some would suggest. In fact, I'm not sure we even need it at all. So, you know, I'm sure everyone gets excited when they hear that. But before you call me crazy, let's look at a few points. Much of the research supporting fiber consumption for everything from intestinal motility to cancer prevention to cardiovascular health is based on sketchy associative data. Dietary fiber can be broken down, I couldn't resist, into two classes, soluble and insoluble. Soluble fiber is that gooey type found in plant matter that absorbs water to a great degree. Insoluble fiber is primarily cellulose. That's like plant cell walls, sawdust, and it's largely indigestible, passes through the small intestine, and resides in the large intestine or colon, where it ferments. And we humans have a limited capacity for hindgut fermentation compared to other primates. And it supposedly, or actually does, feed our gut bugs. So those gut bugs are the 100 trillion or so microbes, including bacteria, yeast, and fungi, that inhabit our bodies and exist symbiotically with us, participating in a number of cell signaling and manufacturing processes. I'll discuss fiber in the context of two topics, constipation and microbiome proliferation. When considering the rate or duration of processing in the alimentary canal, constipation would be deemed to be a very slow rate or excessively long duration between ingestion and passing of food. Constipation describes an inefficiency which ultimately impairs regularity and is associated with discomfort. It is in the context of the standard American diet where constipation becomes a concern. The highly processed food of the SAD is usually implicated in most cases of constipation. Eating fresh, whole, natural, minimally processed foods, that's the ancestral diet or the planet-based diet, has generally been shown to normalize digestion and regularity, assuming the diet has been personalized appropriately. But take a mixture of flour, sugar, and oil in varying ratios, and some examples are crackers, cookies, pasta with commercial sauces, and you get a product that, when liquefied, turns into a slurry-like white or beige paste. This is very similar to the recipe for making plaster of Paris that is often used in a school art class. That sticky goo coats everything and hardens into a brick-like substance. Now envision a mix of energy bars, bread, soda, and chips in your gut. That plaster packs into your digestive tract and virtually forms a glue plug, slowing the whole works down to a crawl. Now, this is where you actually do need fiber. When you eat a diet of glue plug forming paste, you need fiber to add bulk, as is commonly said, to your GI tract. Swell with water and bang on that glue plug like a hammer until it forces the whole shebang to the desired outcome. Obviously, you should do your own experiments here, and I'll stay on the safe side of TMI. But when I eat healthy, nutrient-dense natural food, I have optimal GI function and no need for a high fiber diet. You can even score your restroom performance with the Bristol Stool Scale. You can look that up should you care to do so. The scale is quite graphic and it helps to explain how infrequent pellet deposition is just as bad as 5 times daily paint sprayer explosions should you glance in the rearview mirror. Neither is an indicator of gut or overall health. Let's take a look at what is currently one of the hottest topics in the health scene, the gut microbiome and its relationship to diet. It's well understood that we humans are a host to a plethora of microorganisms and that there's a complex and, as I mentioned previously, symbiotic relationship in existence. However, the nuances of this relationship are far from completely understood at this time. My feeling is that both scientific research and popular opinion got a little excited over the last decade on this topic. Based on microbiome analyses of several equatorial hunter-gatherer populations who are healthy and long-living for what are probably many reasons, not just diet, it became a general assumption that most humans should possess microbiota that resemble these groups. It quickly became conventional wisdom that we need to have similar gut profiles in terms of bacterial strains across populations, and that we need to eat a high volume of prebiotic fiber and resistant starch to support these microbes. Now, is it just me, or does this seem like a leap of faith? If the human is the alpha creature on Earth, Should we eat to support our microbiome, or is it designed to adapt and respond to our genetically linked historical food sources? Assuming we don't eat sad, processed garbage, which has been shown to cause proliferation of undesirable bacterial strains, matching up our fiber volume with specific hunter-gatherers might be a practice worth examining more closely. The population studies have existed for millennia. Eating a subsistence diet that contained high volumes of fibrous tubers and other plant matter, among other things. Over many generations, these populations have developed a gut profile that enhances their ability to digest and extract nutrition from these food sources. With an open mind, I tried to embrace this line of thinking and eating, and I experimented with gradually introducing and building up a high volume of fibrous plant matter in my diet. What I found was that even though I performed this practice over several months, on several occasions, over several years, my body was not receptive to the intervention. My inflammation markers went up again, I had significant gut distress, and after several tries, I abandoned that pursuit. My genome is entirely Northwestern European and Scandinavian, and I have many generations of adaptation to an entirely different dietary makeup and probably gut microbiome population than people of equatorial ancestry. And I'm saying that at least over the past 20,000 years, recognizing that we all started out in Africa at some point. I talked about that for quite a while. And this diatribe's getting longer than I had originally intended. I'm going to stop here. I'm going to call this part one of two or more, possibly, and return with some additional topics and experiments. I want to share information about protein, fat, carbs, training, dairy products, cholesterol, supplements, and several other areas that have been part of my dietary experiments. My goal is to share and report, but also to give you some ideas that you can explore to make your diet more personally appropriate and healthy. Thanks for joining me and catch you next time. Thank you for joining us on the Lifetime Body Podcast, where we kick ass for life through the attainment of ultimate wellness and the pursuit of peak performance and maximum longevity. If you are enjoying this content, please leave us a rating and review wherever you listen to the show and share it with your friends and family. Also, check out thelifetimebody.com, where you can access a variety of publications and media that can help you achieve the highest levels of health, fitness, success, and happiness. And be sure to subscribe to the weekly Kick-Ass for Life update, which keeps you real-time on the latest releases from TLB. Until next time, this is the Lifetime Body, where science meets common sense and where we help you kick-ass for life.